Danny Bedrosian has a brand new radio show. It's called Danny on Everything. It airs on Moose Magnificat Fridays and Sundays. We're going to do some of the moments in that show with you here today. So you're going to enjoy listening to Danny and his guest. And then I've got a opportunity to bring back to you the Alzheimer's Project in the second hour. So you stay with me. You're going to love it.
Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, brought to you by Widden Glass, Tallahassee's first name in glass for your home or office, and by Merry Maids. Call Merry Maids. Relax. And it's done.
So, what are you going to do?
I don't know. My insurance company is telling me to take it to this one shop, but I don't know if that's the best thing to do.
It's your choice. It's not up to them. Have you told Jerry?
No, he loves that car. I wanted to take it to someone who would make it perfect, just the way it was, you know?
Yeah, well, you know Dan Hendrickson, right?
Dan Hendrickson.
The guy we met at that chamber thingy we went to, remember? He owns Capital City Collision Center. He was talking about the whole Gain Street thing, because he's down there by the stadium on Lake Bradford Road.
And you think they do good work?
You don't remember? Bobby's Jeep got rear-ended coming home from school.
Oh, that's right.
We had Dan fix it. It was great. And they're great to work with. And the guy in the paint shop is really cute.
Capital City did that.
Yep. I've got his card here somewhere. Here.
Okay. Capital City Collision Center.
Online at CapitalCityCollisionInc.com or call 575-9202. Welcome again, my friend, to another exciting edition of Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, the radio show that you just love to make fun of. I know, you're over there throwing spit wads at me, aren't you? It's all right. I'm an easy target. But you know what? What really makes me happy is to find out after the fact, people will come back to me various places and times and talk about having heard the show, enjoying a particular guest or a topic that they have found encouraging or informative or entertaining, amusing, whatever. And that characterizes what is Tallahassee, the new Tallahassee. So many new things going on. And if you weren't with us last week, Brian Deloge was here, Commissioner Brian Deloge, talking with us about the growth of the region, really. Certainly Leon County, Tallahassee area, but if you look around, that growth is remarkably aggressive. To me, it's more than just buildings going up and projects being launched and initiated or whatever. It's more than even the entrepreneurial innovation that we always like to brag about around town. It has to do with an attitude, I think. It's a sort of mindset. It is what characterizes a community, I think, when we conceive of ourselves in a manner that is reflective of the stuff that we care about. What do we really invest in? Historically, we've invested well in parks and recreation and education. And so for its last, 10, 20 years, Tallahassee has been recognized nationally as a great place to raise kids. You hear that all the time. Well, why? Why is it such a good place for kids? I mean, there's lots of places where you can raise families, but it seems to me that it's more than the infrastructure. It's more than the perhaps a bit more relaxed lifestyle. I mean, you know, when it comes to things like crime and poverty and income entrenchment, I mean, we're not able to hold a lot of bragging rights there. We are struggling in that capacity. You know, our community continues to fight through segregation in various ways, whether it's income and lifestyle or race and gender and such. Nonetheless, given all of our challenges, and we got plenty of them, there seems to be a determination, I think, to find a new way of being, a new expansion of what it means to be Tallahassee, that is a bit more inclusive, that is more encompassing. and open to all kinds of ways in which we can get things done, that we can do things for one another. And so in the show today, I've got Danny Bedrosian with his contribution to that effort. You know, for those who are getting to know him, Danny, for his part, has been a world-class musician for decades, touring with none other than George Clinton for the last 13, 14 years. So here he comes with his own radio show, Danny on Everything, and that airs on Moose Magnificat Fridays at 5:30 and Sunday afternoons at 1. Now, it's not weekly. It's periodic, we'd say, which is even, again, a bit of a new Tallahassee approach, right? We're used to something happening at a certain day, a certain time, every week, over and over and over, or every day, or whatever. Well, this is different. and it underscores my point, that the difference is the impetus for doing the show is really content-driven, rather than it being some external, might say even more arbitrary designation. You know, oh, we're going to do a show. We're going to do a show every week at this time and this day. Okay? And then scramble for content. It's just the other way around. It's, these are things we think are important, and as those come to us, we will assemble those guests, those ideas, those bits of conversation, and bring them to the audience. That's really the premise. And Danny, for his part, is, I think, stalwart in his ability. He is a remarkable conversationalist. And in this particular show, and I'm going to play a good deal of it for you, his guest is well-recognized even internationally. Dr. Michael Bakken, who is a musicologist. In fact, he's a professor of ethnomusicology at Florida State University College of Music, head of the World Music Ensemble Program, and whose book, a textbook, is used by over 200 universities worldwide. This is a man whose achievements in the world of music and musicology are formidable, we would say, are world class. So Danny brings this fella to the to his show, then, for us to have this inside opportunity to hear in conversation what he thinks about and what he spends his time doing. I'm telling you, folks, if you want to be a bit more elevated in your understanding of the world and of music, and of education and musicology, man, you got to stay tuned. And Danny makes it so enjoyable. Anyway, so he'll be with us here in this first hour of the show. And then, with the legislative session now underway, we're talking again about how we care for one another, especially seniors. And you may have noticed, would be difficult to not notice, that Tallahassee is now replete with managed care facilities, generally speaking. Some of these are memory care. Some of them are the more customary convalescent centers or retirement homes. But those that have come on board of late are more aimed at specific issues regarding memory. And so I thought, how appropriate. We ought to bring back in conversation the folks with Alzheimer's Project. Now, this organization, for its part, focuses on the needs of those people who are supporting and caring for someone who is challenged with Alzheimer's disease. Okay, so if you're the spouse or the child of, or even the parent of, someone with Alzheimer's, this support group, Alzheimer's Project, is there for you. And they do such a remarkable work. It is the kind of work that is 24/7. And is supplementary to the actual residential care that folks need in this capacity. But it really gives the caregiver, the person who is the family member, a chance to breathe. And anyway, I think you'll enjoy that conversation. Bringing back to you some information here in the way of family activity. coming up the 27th, January 27th, here the month of, on a Saturday, the 13th annual Daddy-Daughter Dance. So don't forget about that. If you want to find them online, you can go to RotaryDDD.com. You can get tickets there, and they've got two different dances. I guess what they're calling a tea dance from 5 to 7 for the younger set, and then the traditional daddy-daughter dance starts at 7. The 13th annual Daddy-Daughter Dance, benefiting the Rotary Club of Tallahassee, Northside. Don't forget, you can find us online at TallahasseeTalks.com. If you have a topic, send us an email, topics@TallahasseeTalks.com. Stay with me.
Widen Glass takes care of Tallahassee business. Local contractors know Widen Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. They prefer Widen Glass because of their precise window glass replacement, masterful shower enclosures, and storefront glass. Widen Glass will take care of you to your complete satisfaction. That's been Widen's way of doing business for 65 years. When you call Widen Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Widen's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Widen Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. We've done hundreds of storefronts in the Tallahassee area. That's why Widen is known for taking care of business. Widen Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.
Changing the face of talk radio in Tallahassee. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Danny Bedrosian has a brand new show, and as promised, I wanted to bring you some of the outtakes from his first broadcast. I think you're going to really like this. He is his first guest, Michael Bakken. That's all I'm going to say. Wow. So stay with me. Here is Danny Bedrosian, Danny on everything.
Tell us a little bit about where you came from originally and what your roots are.
All right. So I was born in East Lansing, Michigan. My parents both taught at Michigan State University, so I came out of a kind of an academic environment and became involved in music at about 3 years old when I got my first Beatles record, Beatles 6 with 8 days a week and all that kind of stuff. And I used to just, you know, bang around on pots and pans in the kitchen and so on and so forth. And then one day my parents were at the Junior League thrift shop and they saw this box of junk in it. And my mom thought it was pots and pans and my dad said, no, that's a drum. And so they bought the drum and they brought it home and there was a kid down the street who was a guitar player, so they figured he'd know how to put together a drum. And so he put it together. It turns out, just by coincidence, that that guy is a guy named Marty Rokich, who's now also a music professor, a composer out in California, so nice. You never know. Anyway, so he put together the drum, and then I had a little plastic guitar and a Sgt. Pepper suit, and I'd just go down in the basement and spend my days, you know, banging away on the drum, playing on the guitar, and thinking I was the fifth Beatle. So that was really the beginning. And then when I was about six, my sister had taken up the violin, and then she had given it up quickly, and there was this little half-size violin in the hallway, and I felt sorry for the violin, so I thought it needed a friend, so I started playing the violin. So I did violin and drums for a long time. Then when I was nine, started playing my brother's rock band. When I was 11, got into playing jazz, taking lessons, getting a little more serious, and then my mind was blown when I was 11 and my drum teacher told me, oh, there's this concert, you know, jazz concert, you might find it interesting. Turned out it was a double bill of Weather Report and Billy Cobham.
Oh, very nice.
And so that was my total sort of conversion experience. And once I heard Billy Cobham, I'm like, okay, that's the goal right there.
Right.
And, you know, kind of interesting coincidentally that it was Billy Cobham who sort of explored so many interesting things with, you know, Indian rhythmic systems and world music kinds of ideas through Mahavishnu Orchestra and things like
right.
that. And then eventually, much later, not that much later, I mean, when I was 15 is when I started getting into some of the West African music and gamelan and things like that. And then eventually went through, got my degree in percussion performance at the University of Toronto. But my teacher there, Russell Hartenberger, was also an ethnomusicologist, great percussionist with Nexus and the Steve Reich Ensemble, but he had also studied South Indian music and done a dissertation on that, did a lot of West African music. And so I got into all that kind of stuff. And then the sad part of the story is when I was in my early 20s, I lost the use of my arms, had a very bad chronic pain condition, and kind of had to give up playing for a while. And that's when I kind of shifted gears and ended up, you know, going to graduate school in ethnomusicology. And as it turned out, that worked out pretty well for me.
I'm sure many people are very thankful for that turn of bad luck.
Yeah, yeah.
So what brought you to Florida State specifically? Was there something about that university that that directed you there?
Yeah, a job.
Yeah, right. Nice.
I didn't know a whole lot about Florida State. You know, I was when I finished my PhD at UCLA, I was lucky enough to move straight into a teaching position at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. But that was a one-year position. Mm. It was sort of temporary thing. Somebody had left at last minute, and I walked into that. They needed somebody who could teach ethnomusicology and direct a Balinese gamelan, so I seized that opportunity. But then, you know, it wasn't clear whether that was going to turn into a permanent position. So meanwhile, I was out, you know, applying for everything in the world. So I applied for positions at, you know, I applied and actually got interviews at Harvard, at Pomona College out in California, at Wayne State in Detroit. Mm. And then eventually the Bowling Green job did go tenure track and I did get offered the position. But by that time, I had already, you know, gone on the rails for the Florida State job. And once I came down here and checked out what was happening, they had the great ethnomusicologist Dale Olson was here and he was very cool and, you know, very, very friendly. And I thought this would be a great place to be. And I also wanted to live where it was warm.
Right.
But the great thing for me was that, so I was kind of kept on the hooks with Harvard. Their search kept sort of dragging on and on. And they were sort of like, well, yeah, you're still under consideration. And finally, you know, after being kind of put on hold for a long time, they offered me the job the day of my interview at Florida State. So I had the great pleasure of being able to call the folks at Harvard and saying, eh, no thanks. So that's how I came here.
Very nice. Yeah.
It's, you know, also I had heard, you know, that Florida State was known for two things that I knew about. One, they had a very good football team. Then they had one of kick-ass College of Music. And,
okay.
And so that was, it was very attractive.
For sure. Yeah. Now, I was, as I tour for a living, as you know, I was in Bali. We're talking about the Balinese gamelan ensemble.
Yeah.
And upon already knowing your lengthy resume in the past, I already knew that you had already published a great book on the history of Balinese music, about the you know, traditions of Balinese
gamelan music.
Yeah. It's called the, so I get it right, Music of Death and New Creation, Experiences in the World of Balinese Gamelan, Balaganjor?
Actually, that was pretty good.
Hey! Which was put out by University of Chicago Press in 1999. That's your first...
That was my first book.
Publication, the first book. Now, I went to Bali for my first time just a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And just like I thought, whenever I mentioned your name, people in the music industry knew exactly who you were and who I was talking about. Uh-huh. I said, oh, yes, of course we know Michael Backe. Yeah. Michael Backe is a big deal and da 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 da. And that's, I was funny, really proud to know you, and I had I'd played them the rendition that we had done of George Clinton's Atomic Dog with the Balinese gamelan ensemble, which was a great connecting point since I was there with George playing in Bali, and they were so proud and happy to know that there was some connection with this American artist.
Yeah.
I want you to tell us about your connection to Balinese culture
and
what really initially attracted. I know that you said you got into FSU. They had the Balinese gamelan program already when you first went
there? Actually, no. What happened? So at Bowling Green, they had a gamelan there because there had been a woman who taught there. It's a funny story, actually. So then I got the interview at Florida State. I come here and they offered me the job the day of the interview, which I wasn't expecting, because all the other interviews, it's like, you know, the last thing you do is you meet with the dean and they give you this whole spiel about, oh, here's our tenure and promotion thing and here's the real estate situation. And you're like, who cares? I don't know if I have the job. So, you know, this is like my fifth interview in 7 weeks. I've been all over the country. I'm dealing with all this stuff back, you know, home. And so then the dean, who at the time was John Pearsall, he says, and we've been delighted with your visit here, Michael, and, you know, we know you have other offers on the table, and we'd like you to join us here on the faculty of Florida State. And I was, like, spacing out, thinking about, I'm going to go to the beach tomorrow. And then I'm, like, you know, suddenly catch my attention, like, oh, you know, did you just offer me the job? And he's like, yeah, you know, again, we know, you know, we want you here, and you're our last candidate, and so we're not going to mess around. And so then I'm started, like, sort of trying to fill in the time as I'm trying to think, well, how do I respond to this? And I think, well, I'd have to blah, 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 you know, just kidding, you know, when you're sort of talking one thing and something else is going on in your head. And I just kind of blurted out, well, I guess I'd have to give up my gamelan, because they had the gamelan at Bowling Green. And he just sort of jumped in and said, well, if we bought you a gamelan, would that make the difference?
Oh.
And then I swear, I'm 98% certain this was the next sentence. So I said, well, I'd still have to think about it, but that would certainly make a difference. And then he leaned forward and said, and what's a gamelan? So, and how much does it cost?
Right.
So, right.
Widden Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. When you call Widden Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Widden's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Widden Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. Widden Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781. More beauty, less bully. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
So what we're doing here is we're listening to Danny Bedrosian from his show, Danny on Everything, that debuted here recently on Moose Magnificat. It airs on Fridays at 5:30 and on Sunday afternoons at 1 when it does air, because it isn't pre-decided. Danny's taken the approach that I think is a very healthy approach. Pull together guests and ideas that are worthwhile and are worth your time and listening. You're going to find out we're in segment 2 here, or the next portion of this conversation he had with Michael Bakken. Take a listen.
So anyway, that's how it happened. So actually, I was the one, you know, FSU purchased the gamelan and then sent me over there to commission the building of it, and that's a whole radio show in itself.
Right, right.
That was quite an experience. Yeah,
and it is quite an experience to both see and hear.
Yeah.
The music, the gamelan music,
yeah.
and it really is another world. I mean, as someone who plays quote unquote Western music, but grew up in an Armenian culture too. Balinese music is so far afield from anything that I have ever really heard, both in the instrumentation and in the music theory itself.
That's right.
Can you, without, you know, I guess, like you said, a whole
without
book.
Writing another written, book about
without
it.
Writing another book
right,
about it.
Right, right.
Just for the listeners, what are some central themes of gamelan? What are some central themes of maybe Balinese music that aren't so common or orthodox to the Western music that we know?
Sure, I can do that. So, I mean, the first thing you got to understand is that you're entering into a totally different sonic universe. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, 90% of the instruments are bronze percussion instruments.
Right.
So we have slab metallophones, kind of like, you know, like a xylophone or a vibraphone, but with bronze keys. And then we have all these different kinds of gongs, you know, from little tiny ones to great big ones that are like, you know, 90 inches across. And some of those gongs are set up on, you know, racks where they're played as melodic instruments, and others of them are punctuating instruments to mark out particular times within the cycles of the music. Mm. So we have this kind of shimmering quality of bronze that sort of permeates the whole space. Adding to that is the unique way in which these instruments are tuned. It's what we call paired tuning. So if we are tuning Western instruments, you bring in your piano tuner, right?
Sure.
He's got his A440, he's got his pitchfork, and everything's kind of set up with the exact intervals. Well, in Bali, it's a quite different system. You have a male and a female version of every instrument. Hmm. And those two instruments, which are kind of thought of as one composite instrument, are tuned so that the pitch is a little bit apart. Now, when you get into the really low pitch ones, that would be like the equivalent of a semitone.
I was going to say, it must be a semitone.
Piano.
Yeah, yeah.
But when they're struck together, they create this what's called ombak, a wave, an acoustical beating wave that goes whoa, 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 whoa.
Ah.
Now, the further up you go with these paired instruments into the high pitch ones, that difference goes from being a semitone to being a tiny microtone. But the way it's tuned is not to the specific frequencies, but rather to the rate of oscillation of that acoustical beating of that ombak. So the tiniest instruments and the large instruments all vibrate at the same rate. So you have whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, 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 whoa.
Right.
And the key art of the tuning is to figure out how close do we have to make the intervals on the little instruments and how big do we have to make on the big instruments so that that shimmering, that wave, that mechanical vibrato consumes the whole space. On top of that, as you go from octave to octave with the registers of the different instruments, the octaves are actually stretched. So if you're on a piano, you have an exact octave from, you know, C to C to C to C all the way up. Well, if you did that with the gamelan, this C would be, you know, a few cents higher than the C below it, and then that one a few cents. Oh. So that you get this stretching of the octave vertically and the stretching of the octave horizontally in the paired tuning. The idea behind all of that is that there's this sense, you know, if you do yoga or meditation, you know, Indian-based systems, Hindu-based systems. This is a Hindu culture in Bali.
Right, right.
Most
Bali
of Indonesia is Muslim.
Right. Yeah, right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, but the idea is that, you know, like when you go Om, you know, the universal sound, the sound of creation, well, that every sound, you know, you've heard the old cliche that the entire universe is contained in a grain of sand, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's the same idea that the entire universe is contained within everything that exists within it.
Ah.
So that within every pitch, within every sonic event, every time a note is played, when the gamelan goes, bang, right, that is the whole universe right there. So by stretching out the octaves vertically and horizontally, we get that idea of an entire universe in every sonic event. Similarly, when the music is actually played, and especially more in the Javanese than in the Balinese style of gamelan,
interesting,
the articulation is intentionally out of time.
Oh.
So that when, you know, the different instruments are struck, quote unquote, you know, on the beat,
yep,
the big gong will come a little bit later than the small, you know,
kind
metal
of contrapuntal, yeah, if you will.
It's more like not so much contrapuntal, but it's like, so you have counterpoint, you have, yeah, different melodies going on at the same time, but this is more like just a note. So like if we all had, like if an orchestra goes bomb, the Javanese especially would go bomb.
Oh, interesting.
And so it just, okay, sounds like, oh, these guys can't play together. You know,
right,
they're,
right,
not,
right,
very good ensemble. But
that's
actually
intended. That's
it's
the
intended, yeah, again, to stretch out the time so that every event is getting that whole sort of that cosmos within itself.
Right.
So those are a couple of things. And then,
yeah,
then the other thing that happens, you get these interlocking parts. So that in Balinese gamelan, all the melody parts, pretty much, at least once you get into the embellishment of the melody, rather than having one person play a melodic part, it's like two people are playing it, you know, pocketing style.
Sure.
These guys got half the notes, this guy's got the other half notes. It's sort of the opposite of the Western concept. We're always trying to get, like, the drum set player, you know.
Yeah.
He's going to do the cymbal and the hi-hat and the bass drum and snare drum. You know, get one person to do what four used to do down, yeah, in New Orleans parade.
Right.
In Bali, it's the opposite. We can get three people to do what one person could do. That's better. Why? Because it creates tightness of the community.
Right, right. Interesting. It's very, very fascinating, and there are some parallels to other types of world music, and then,
sure,
some that have no parallel to me, at least in,
that's
my,
right,
sonically, for me hearing it when,
that's,
I was,
right,
in Bali. It,
yeah,
really just took my breath away, and I can see how you could write several books on this.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, something that really blew me away, your textbook, World Music Traditions and Transformations, which was published by McGraw-Hill.
Mm.
It's been adopted in more than 150 universities and colleges nationwide and internationally.
Well, actually, it's up to 250
now.
Oh,
whoa. Incredible. That, yeah, that, yeah, that is just, you should be so proud. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
deserved, but should be so proud. And there's, if I'm not mistaken, a third edition is coming out soon.
Yeah, the third edition will be out October 1st, according to all the records. And I'm very excited about third edition because in the first couple of editions, we've been kind of beholden to 20th century technology. There's been a CD set that accompanies the book.
Sure.
And so you have to license everything, and you can only have so much time on four CDs or whatever it is. Well, now in the third edition, McGraw-Hill has a contract with Spotify.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
I can use anything on Spotify. No,
nice,
more excerpts, no more choosing between this and that. So basically the music playlist has gone from 107 tracks on the second edition to 320 tracks on the third,
amazing,
edition. So basically every time now that you come to a name, you know, James Brown, Taylor Swift, whatever,
sure,
you just go boom and you click and there you've got it.
Wow.
And so that's been a kind of a, you know, kind of a revolutionary, liberatory experience for me as the author of a book, because I always wanted to be able to include all the music, but, you know, you couldn't get things. Like, you couldn't use Beyonce because they couldn't afford the licensing, or they couldn't,
yeah,
get the license. And
right,
now it's if it's on Spotify, and the amazing thing was that all the stuff I had, like 95% of it was already on Spotify.
As well as a good amount of world music. Because
I mean, including all the,
yeah,
world music.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah,
right,
international.
Right.
It doesn't,
yep,
matter what country you're in.
There.
Very few countries have a ban on something like Spotify.
That's right.
There are some. But,
yeah,
but even in Bali, going back to Bali really quickly, I was listening to Balinese pop bands.
Oh, yeah.
When I was there,
yeah,
on Spotify.
On Spotify.
You know, interviews,
absolutely,
with them and things like that.
Yep.
I also want to talk to you about the artism project. Mm-hmm. And both its connection to the center in Florida, as well as the book that you have coming. You have another book coming out that deals specifically with this.
Well, okay. There's no simple answers when you're asking me questions.
Nice. That's okay. That's good.
I'll give you a quick sort of backstory to the new book, which sort of encompasses the Artism Ensemble. Okay, so going back to 2003, here I was, sort of a mid-career ethnomusicologist, you know, recently tenured, teaching in Florida State, had a couple of books out, another, you know, textbook, first edition, on its way, whatever. There was a sort of a total radical shift in my life when a kid came into my family network who, you know, was diagnosed at about the age of 3 as being on the autism spectrum with mm-hmm. Asperger syndrome. And so there's a close relationship I had with this kid, but I didn't really know how to kind of get in, you know, because I didn't know what was going on because this was all new to me.
Trucking Hard Concepts, we're your one-stop shop for tripping out to truck. Trucking Hard Concepts, people with their cars, we're number one by far. Bed liners, bed caps, toys to throw your money at. Car stereos, car alarms, things for all you soccer moms. Tail and diamond plate, parts to fix your tailgate. Truck and Car Concepts, we're your one-stop shop for tricking out your truck. Truck and Car Concepts, people with their cars, we're number one by far. Exterior accessories, gift kit for your mud needs. Mud tires, nice wheels, everyone will get a deal. Window tinting, that's a must, come on out and visit us. Truck and Car Concepts, one-stop shop, we always aim to please. Truck and Car Concepts, everything is here from A to Z.
Now we're really talking. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
So this is the third part of this show, Danny on Everything, with Danny Bedrosian and his guest Michael Backen. Thanks for hanging in here with me. I think you're going to find that in going forward, Danny Bedrosian is going to bring you some of the most interesting people on the planet on all kinds of different topics. This happened to be his first show with Dr. Backen. I think you've already discovered this is radio worth listening to. So let's take another listen.
And then I had my then colleague Ben Cohen, who used to teach at Florida State. He's now in China teaching at a university there. But he was over at the house for the first time. We were, you know, just jamming, playing some drums after dinner. And this kid who, you know, would always kind of, you know, disappear whenever company came over or whatever, he emerged out of his bedroom and came while we were playing and just joined in with us.
Wow.
And it was just kind of this magical, amazing experience. And suddenly there was this kind of connection. And afterwards, this kid who would always kind of, you know, like wouldn't speak English even though he could and would kind of always carry a lot of tension in his body, suddenly he was like relaxed and he was talking lucidly and he was using his, you know, hands to gesture while he was speaking, just like a total change. And it was just like, this is what I got to do.
It was very obvious that the music had sparked something.
Music had done something, right. Mm. And so I just, somehow I have to create, you know, what am I? I'm a musician. I'm an ethnomusicologist. Right. Somehow I have to make this what I, you know, rather than going back to Bali or whatever else, I got to do this. Mm-hmm. And so I essentially found a way to create the ethnomusicology of autism. And that kind of, it was very strange initially for the field, but because I was already somewhat known, people were like, okay, you know, we'll publish this stuff.
And specificity is very important in academia.
Right.
A true academician is very specific.
You got to find the niche. I had passion for it. So it went there. And so first there was this project called the Music Play Project, which was kind of more therapeutic. Hmm. Then a few years later, there was the Artism Project, where essentially it was almost like, you know, these video games like Guitar Hero or something, where you had these kids on the autism spectrum. They would come in, we'd have this what we call the EWOMP, the Exploratory World Music Playground. We have all kinds of cool instruments all over the place, and they could just do whatever they want. But on top of that, we had a band of great musicians from all over the world, some of whom, you know, Dan, you know, Carlos Odria, Carlos Silva, people like that.
Yeah, and fantastic.
And so they were kind of there at the whim of these kids to sort of say, okay, you do this, you do that. And so we got this grant from the National Endowment of the Arts, and we put together this ensemble, and we went out and did, you know, big concerts and, you know, did, web broadcasts and all kinds of things. So that was Arts with Kids. And out of that, you know, a whole bunch of interesting things happened. You can read about it if you want in the book when it comes out.
Nice.
But that kind of segued into this project where I was interviewing autistic musicians from all over the world, from Israel, from Canada, from all over the United States, and mainly interviewing them online, text messaging interviews, and, you know, about their experiences as musicians living in the world as autistic people.
Amazing.
And those conversations become the basis of the new book, which is called Speaking for Ourselves: Conversations on Life, Music, and Autism. And I'm very fortunate and happy that the book has been accepted for publication by Oxford University Press.
Very nice.
And so it'll be out on June 1st. I'm very excited about
that. That's fantastic. On June 1st. And speaking of books, this is your fourth book. Right?
Well, it depends how you count. I mean, you know, the main books are, so there's Music of Death, New Creation, there's the World Music Textbook, and then there's this book. But because the World Music Textbook has been published in multiple
editions. Sure.
So we'll call it five.
Okay, fantastic. And then, okay, so that's coming out in 2018.
Both the third edition of World Music and the autism book are coming out. Let me just qualify one thing before I go on, because some people, if they're in the world of therapy and so on, speech therapy, working with autistic people, might think, well, why is he saying autistic people? Why isn't he saying people with autism? Because there's sort of debate about the correct terminology.
Oh, really? Okay.
So there's what's called person-first language, where you say a person with autism, and that has become considered more respectful. However, people who are autistic, at least the people that I'm working with, they say, no, we don't like that. We are autistic people. Because if you say people with autism, it implies there's something bad about
autism. Right, that it's a condition.
Yeah. It's like, you don't say you're a person with Armenianness.
Right, exactly. Right.
So just to qualify that.
Ah, it's very interesting. Yeah. Also, I wanted to touch on something that you have done for several years, I believe, at FSU, the Rainbow Concert.
Yeah.
And this is going into, it will be, 2018 will be the what?
21st, I believe.
Wow, I was going to say like 15.
Maybe even the 22nd, I'm losing track.
And you were involved in all of the, every single one of them?
Yeah, well, I was there, Dale Olson, who I talked about earlier,
right.
He was my senior colleague until 2008 when he retired. He still lives here in town,
he's
very much part of the community. Hey, Dale, if you're listening. he came up with, they have this big thing, the PRISM concert. It's a big institution at FSU where it's like they bring out, you know, the marching chiefs, the big 400-piece marching band. They got all the orchestras and the choirs. And so Dale came up with this idea. Well, why don't we do like a PRISM concert, but we'll do it world music with all of our world music ensembles? Because we have like the largest world music performance program in the country.
Arguably. I didn't know that.
Certainly in the southeastern United States. Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic.
You know, like 10, 11 ensembles going in all the time. And
wow.
So I was kind of, my first thought was, oh man, that sounds like a logistical nightmare, you know, it's just a lot of work. But, you know, I was let's do it. So we did it, and then this tradition started of, you know, bringing in a guest artist every year. So this coming year, the 2018 concert, which will be on Friday, March the 2nd at Ruby Diamond Concert Hall, will feature a wonderful artist who you know also, Haichung.
Oh, nice. Oh,
Haichung, who's
genius. She is absolute genius. I love playing with her. She's an amazing musician.
So she's like, one of the world's greatest Chinese Zhong players.
Right.
Chinese is like the harp zither.
Yes.
And she actually won in 1995. She won the National Zhong Competition of China. That's like winning the Leventritt Piano Competition.
Sure, sure. Yeah, so exactly.
She truly is world class. And she's now in her third year of her PhD. I'm her dissertation advisor. And she's off to China next year to do her field research for her dissertation. So this is going to be a big send-off for her.
Gotcha.
But we've been fortunate to have some really amazing guest artists, including yourself.
It was an honor. Myself and my boss, Mr. George Clinton.
Yes, indeed.
We got to do a P-Funk-themed rainbow concert where several of the ensembles played a different song from the vast discography of P-Funk's music. And it was an absolute pleasure. I had so much fun going in and rehearsing with the groups, meeting all the kids, the students, the adults, the professors, all the staff, all the people. Everyone was just so, so wonderful, and I know George really loved it too. And you also, I wanted to talk also about one of the ensembles that I've both seen before and after the Rainbow concert several times and worked with Omni Musica, which is your baby, basically. Right. And I know that you, I think you guys, are you on hiatus this semester? Or?
No, we're still active.
Okay.
But we will be, I was on what's called research-oriented semester in the fall, so I was not teaching any of my regular classes, but I did do Omni Musica just for kicks and giggles, you know.
Professor Michael, it has been endlessly fascinating, as always. I could talk to you for hours about all of this stuff and many other things. Congratulations on your continued success, and we hope we can have you come back and talk to us some more soon in the future.
Absolutely. I'll come back anytime, and if this is your first time being the interviewer as opposed to interviewee, you're a natural.
Hey!
You did an awesome job.
Nice.
It's been a pleasure. It's been really fun.
Professor Michael Bakken, and we'll be right back. Thank you very much.
In 1788, Robert Burns wrote a poem to herald the coming of the new year and set the lyrics to an old Scottish tune. The little song became quite popular among the Scots and the British as the words recalled the days gone by, bidding farewell to the old and welcoming the new. Band leader Guy Lombardo is often credited with popularizing the use of the song at New Year's celebrations in America. Through his annual broadcasts on radio and television, beginning in 1929, the song became his trademark. This New Year's Eve, millions will gather across the world in celebration and at the stroke of midnight, join together in singing Auld Lang Syne. Here's wishing you all the best and brightest in the new year from Tiffany Hamilton, broker of Eck and Hamilton Realty. Call 850-366-8433 or online at tiffanyhamilton.com. And Witt & Glass on South Monroe. Call 222-5781. Online at wittandglass.com. And Dr. Scott Pliskin at Mayhan Animal Clinic. Call 402-0557.
The most talked about topics in town. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Welcome back to this here fine radio show, Tallahassee Talks, bringing you the very best in our efforts to share with you the things that are of greatest consequence, of greatest interest around town. What everybody's talking about this week, we'd like to say. Or within a framework of time frame that is top of the mind. You know, what are the things that you think of? And I often do this with folks, either here on the show or I'll do so in conversation elsewhere. It's like, when you think of Tallahassee, what comes to mind? Well, the old Tallahassee would have been state capital. Florida State football, the recount of a presidential election, and a Florida Supreme Court decision that was highly controversial. Those are very common. I think these days the conversation is shifting, and it's not simply by the efforts of a few. It seems to me it's a kind of migratory move. You know, it's some of it is by design. Some of it is because we have chosen to go in directions that embrace new technologies or embrace new ways of solving problems. Some of it is because we've welcomed to our population people from outside of the area. People who hail from larger metropolitan areas especially, and then those who come by way of Florida State University or FAMU or TCC and decide to stay. There's certainly been a good deal of effort to encourage that activity, retaining that creative class of individual who doesn't share the old way necessarily, doesn't come up out of that old mindset. And you talk to people who were born in Tallahassee, reared here. I think of Shelley Gomez, for example, or Lauren Pace over there at Visit Tallahassee. And they'll tell you, I mean, it's a new town. It's a different way of thinking, different way of feeling about who we are. You know, when I was a younger man in graduate school, working on a doctorate in social research and sociology, one of my mentors then was fond of saying that when everything seems to be falling apart, it's the best indication that scientific progress is being made. That was part of the thinking behind allowing the inquiry, the investigation into any question to take you wherever it's going to go, to not try to guide that questioning or affect the outcome of the questioning, I should say. In other words, don't try to come up with the answer and then find a question to fit it. If you want to know how people better get along, if you want to know how people better do business, if you want to know how people better raise their kids or buy a house, if you want to know better what we do to entertain ourselves or protect the environment or enjoy the environment that we have been given, well, perhaps those questions should be allowed to pursue all kinds of, let's say, non-traditional forms, right? Non-traditional answers. Let the chips fall. Let's try something new that hasn't been done before. Let's move outside of those old conclaves of people who have the power and the money and the influence to make those decisions for us. It's part of, from my way of thinking, getting up off of the plantation and deciding that we're not just working the land anymore, that we're part of the ownership. We have an equity share in the outcome. We have a stake in this. We're not just hired hands or enslaved workers. We are those who have contribution intellectually. And so it was this last week when Village Square hosted this community forum over there at the Moon, talking about race and race relations, talking about what it means to be a person of color in 2018 in Tallahassee. Healthy kind of conversation, one that should be ongoing. We've had in the last year all of this controversy about leadership, particularly the city side, and investigations regarding CRA. That should be an ongoing question that we don't settle on at any one time. How do we do business at the county and city level? How do we do business at the state level? Here we have the session now for 2018. Legislative session has begun. Already, I think on the opening day, there was a proposal to move the state capitol. Yeah, well, before we all jump up out of our chairs and, you know, run around with our hair on fire, let's entertain the question. Not in a way that is designed to shut down the questioning, and not in a way that is designed to cut it off before it has a chance to breathe. Let's ask the question of ourselves, why should we remain as the state capital? And if your answer is, well, because I got a job here. Okay, yeah, I get that. Well, because all the people that, you know, are employed by state government would be without employment, or they'd have to relocate or whatever. Right, I understand that too. I'm asking you to step away from your immediate concerns, be they economic or personal in some fashion. Whatever your initial reactions might be to that. And I'm picking on this question because it's one for all of us that we can all relate to very easily. And allow yourself the moment. What would that be like? And more importantly, how would that be of advantage to the people of Florida? In other words, be a bit more objective, right? And allow yourself to get immersed in the business of what that would do for us as a community. Play the pros and the cons. What if we had the opportunity to reshape, redefine what is Tallahassee in that, no doubt, cataclysmic way? If you want to take the argument in favor of retaining and maintaining Tallahassee as the state capital, well, what's your argument? If it's something that we bring to the table intrinsically, then let that be our position. I mean, you know, you can, as has been done already, I think the chamber immediately issued this cry of no, foul. You know, that's what a horrible idea this is. Okay. But you see my point that I think we have to be willing to ask an honest question and say, if we are to be the state capital, why? What is it that we offer that couldn't be offered elsewhere in the state? What is it that we find most contributive to the business of the people of Florida that we bring quite uniquely? If it's just a PR thing, well, come on. What is it about this town that makes it very, very special? I'm not claiming I have the answers, by all means. I'm asking you and I to continue to ask the question, and it should be an ongoing question that we're never quite satisfied in answering. You stay with me. I've got more.
When you place a document in someone's hand, it should reach more than their head. It needs to reach their heart with compelling visuals and dramatic presentations right down to the paper it's printed on. Rapid Press reaches the hearts of thousands of people every day with commercial printing and mailing services for organizations that feed and house children, for businesses that bring vital products and services to our community, and for theaters, festivals, and orchestras reaching bigger audiences and bringing joy to life. Rapid Press commercial printers since 1983.
For digital printing, offset printing, finishing, and mailing services, reach for Rapid Press. When you're ready to share your vision, excite your customers, and reach the hearts of your audience, reach for Rapid Press. You'll find them online at rapidpress.com or call 893-7346. 893-7346. Rapid Press, the power of print.
Good morning, friends. This is your friend, Dr. Benjamin Franklin. We're talking with Brian Cerny on Tallahassee Talks.
The tragic business of Alzheimer's was brought center stage once again for all of us. For any of us who have been afflicted by this horrible disease. Meanwhile, you have organizations that are devoted to helping those who are such victims and their families endure, to do their very best at bringing resources to bear on what they're faced with. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, I've given you the grisly truth, the bad news, I guess you'd say. The good news is you have people like Debbie Maroney, who you're about to meet. She's the CEO for an organization here in Tallahassee, the Alzheimer's Project. Not to be confused with the Alzheimer's Association. The Alzheimer's Project is a little closer, we might say. I might say it that way. We're going to find out. But let's welcome Debbie Maroney to our show. How are you, my friend?
I'm very good. It's great to be here.
A pleasure. And good to get to know you and the work you're doing. You've been with this organization for some time now. I'm reading from my notes, if you'll forgive me. It says here, so we're sticking to this, right? Debbie Maroney, who is, by the way, a accredited social worker. So she knows some things about people and groups. She has over 30 years of experience working in leadership positions for nonprofit organizations. Graduate of Florida State University, master's in social work, all that good stuff. Done a lot of things around town, including Pace Center for Girls. And here she finds herself heading up this remarkable program, Alzheimer's Project. Debbie, so Alzheimer's Project, am I right? It's not the same as the Alzheimer's Association.
That's correct.
So,
we're a small nonprofit here in Tallahassee, Florida. We serve 9 counties, and we are local services. We provide services locally to caregivers and those living with dementia or Alzheimer's. And so we really do focus on the people living in our community. The Alzheimer's Association does great work in, across the country. They are focused on research. They do have services in other communities, but we've been the primary service organization in our local community.
And your focus is the care of those.
It's caring for the caregiver.
All those who are afflicted. So, okay, so not necessarily the person who is suffering with
Alzheimer's. We kind of have reframed things a little bit. I'm just going to, you talk about being afflicted and victims.
Yeah.
And we really have been listening to those people living with Alzheimer's. Yeah. And they really say, we don't want to be considered victims.
Ah.
We want to be called those living with dementia.
I see.
Because they still are alive. They still have a life.
Ah.
And how we respond to them and the quality of life they have, we have an impact on. And so we've kind of we're reframing. And we're
restating
really
the situation.
Restating the situation. Yeah. They have a lot to give.
Okay.
And they can receive a lot if we are open to really changing that conversation and changing how we care.
I got you. Okay, so I don't need to think in terms of the victim here. I need to think in terms of a person.
A person that's living with the disease. That's functioning as best they can in their current situation.
And given the characteristics of this affliction...
Correct.
That can be challenging.
It is very challenging.
Yeah.
And then we care for the caregiver or the care partner who is, because oftentimes we're not talking about paid caregivers.
Most often a family member.
It's a family member
a friend,
who needs
somebody.
The support to be able to do the tasks that need to be done day in and day out
24/7.
For a very long
right.
time.
Right, right. Long time meaning years.
Years.
Yeah.
Years.
So this recent passing of the beloved Glenn Campbell, right, produces a video a few years back. It's now making its way to daylight, we'd say, to public attention. Title of the documentary is I'll Be Me.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a firsthand look at his farewell tour, and you get a look at the family, his daughter, his sons, particularly his wife, dealing with this day in and day out, and you get to see the progressive nature of this, where it doesn't get better, and the management then that is required of those caregivers becomes more and more intensified. Now, you've brought with you a guest who herself is one of those caregivers, right?
Yes.
So let me introduce Margie Marcille. Margie Marcille. I love the name.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us.
Right here.
No doubt, for you, this is a conversation that I would think you approach with some degree of intrepidation, a certain degree of hesitancy, because it's very fresh for you. Yeah.
It is, and yet there's I guess a responsibility that I feel for helping those who are still dealing with it. My husband passed away. It'll be 2 years in October.
Right.
And I call myself a recovering caregiver because this disease is so totally exhausting for both the person who's living with the disease and the caregivers. You had mentioned it's a 24/7 kind of partnership, and that's exactly what it is. It is absolutely exhausting, emotionally, mentally, physically. It takes everything you have for both of you. So if there's any support I can give to people who are still dealing with it,
mm-hmm.
That kind of overrides the sensitivity to mm-hmm. the issue.
In my relation to your comments, I think of our family, my family, having dealt with a family member who was ill for a long period of time, 5 years, and caring for that individual for those 5 years. So I have a degree of awareness, I mm-hmm. would say. But we're going to learn more from you, I think, as we go forward and from our good friend, our new friend, Debbie Maroney. Folks, you're in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. You stay with me.
Experience, reliability, thoroughness, and professionalism. That's the Merry Maid's way of keeping your home or office at its best. And it's what we have come to expect here at Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. Our studios and offices always shine because Merry Maids makes the difference, like they do for hundreds of offices and homes in Tallahassee. They'll do just the same, just for you. And they're right here, giving back to our community and giving you extra benefits, like saving you up to $400 on your first cleaning by giving you extra service, and saving an extra 10% when you mention Tallahassee Talks. Their website makes it really easy for you, too. You can schedule a cleaning and make a payment with just a few clicks, any day, any time, day or night, when it's convenient for you. Call Merry Maids this week, 850-386-2205. That's 386-2205. Or find them online at merrymaids.com.
Bringing you whatever Tallahassee is talking about this week. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
We're talking about Alzheimer's disease. We're talking about those who we otherwise might think of as victims, but would prefer that we think of them as simply people who are still very much alive and still very much involved in everything that they can be to the very best of their ability in the face of this sort of relentless challenge, the effects of Alzheimer's. And that's quite individualized, isn't it, Debbie? I mean, there isn't a generalization. It doesn't work the same way for every person, does it?
No, it doesn't. When you've seen one dementia, you've seen one dementia.
I see.
Because everybody's experience, everybody's history, everybody's physical and spiritual makeup is different, and how they respond to the disease is going to be different. Mm-hmm. And so you have some individuals who are very pleasant throughout the disease, and then you have some individuals who might become very angry mm-hmm. throughout the disease. You have others that, you know, are very involved for a very extended time, and then you have people that the disease takes them very quickly, so you just really don't know what you're going to get into and what you're going to be facing mm-hmm. because no two stories are alike. I think one of the beauties of Margie's being with us and being involved with us is that caregivers really are the experts, and mm-hmm. they learn from one another mm-hmm. because they learn the different tricks to the trade in terms of taking care of someone, how to deal with it, and then can share at a different level with somebody who's going through it mm-hmm. than somebody who has not gone mm-hmm. through it.
So you have that, I guess, a kind of mentorship there, don't you?
Where, yes.
And certainly a commonality. Margie, that was helpful mm-hmm. for you.
It was very helpful for me. The Alzheimer's Project has a number of support group meetings that they offer different parts of town. And the one I attended, I found so helpful because a number of the people who came to the support group meeting, their loved ones had passed. And they kept coming back and to help and to share what their experiences had been and to problem solve and to brainstorm. And I found that so amazingly helpful.
I imagine.
Amazingly helpful. There's such wisdom in that room. And those people, I still go back to my support group meeting and those people are still there. And then we're, you know, embracing new people as they come in.
You said earlier that your husband passed 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm, yeah. October, it'd be 2 years. Yeah.
How long did he live with dementia?
13 years.
My goodness.
Yeah.
In the early stages of that, how did that affect you personally? Were you horrified? Were you in denial? I mean, did you kind of want to just get up and run away? Or did how did you embrace that?
Well, the first, for several years, actually, my husband was still pretty high-functioning.
Yeah.
And it just became a matter of making sure that there was always somebody aware of what his needs were, where he where he was at all times. I mean, he was still working, and my job takes me around the country, so I would make sure that one of the children was, you know, cued in
alerted
on what he was
on call
if he needed something. And but as it progressed, and I would get phone messages, and I'd be, you know, in the Northeast somewhere, and I'd get a phone message saying, "Now, honey, don't be alarmed, but I'm lost as hell. I don't know where I am. I'll call you back later." So the panic.
Yes.
So as the disease progressed, my work on the road became less and less until the final couple of years of my husband's life, I didn't travel at all. It became too frightening for him. The thing is, the care partner, I like that terminology, by the way, the care partner becomes the anchor, the one person that they will attach to, which is part of why it's so exhausting. They want to be with you every minute. They don't want you to leave their sight. They will follow you around everywhere you go. And so there's that kind of attachment. So when I wasn't around, it would create anxiety and panic because, you know, a lot of times he didn't even know who I was, much less where he was and why he was where he was. And so you can imagine the frustration and the fear and the panic. And then that kind of takes over your life.
And and with that happening, your individual needs,
they don't exist.
Don't exist.
No.
So this sort of horrible multiplex of emotion and motive, this loved one that you want to care for, you want to be there for, at the same time having to look after, how do I function in this? What happens to the rest of my life? So we have two people who are suffering here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why the Alzheimer's Project was so important to me as a caregiver, care partner, because that was the one place that I could go to get support. One of the things that I've discovered, I knew it was true about me just in my nature, but in the support groups and talking to new people on a regular basis these days, we tend not to want to bother other people with asking for help. And I hear this all the time. My children have their own lives to live. I don't want to bother them with this. And at the point at which my children moved back home to help and to spend time with their dad, I said to them, "Oh my God, I didn't realize how much help I needed."
Indeed.
And they said, "We did." And they moved home to help. I wouldn't have asked them. And I think if there's one rewarding piece of this for my children, was they really felt that they had made a contribution and they had given back in a very loving way to their dad. And so I think when we don't ask family members for help, we might actually be robbing them of an opportunity to be loving, loving people to their loved ones who
are
suffering.
And in their own
suffering.
Way find some closure, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah. My children had no regrets. And that was from just allowing them to help. But we won't ask. We don't want to bother them. I hear that all the time.
Debbie, is this a story you hear all the time?
Yes. The care partner really becomes isolated. And they won't ask friends either. And they won't ask family. And lots of times they won't ask us. And so we have to be really vigilant about reaching out and saying, "How are you doing? What do you need? How can we help you? You know, can we connect you with another service?" Because they really do become very focused on what they're doing and don't let anybody else in. And I'm not sure if that's from a fear of, I don't know if somebody else can really handle this, or if it's, you know, something else that's going on. But It's a very lonely place for the care partner.
Well, my friend, we have had this remarkably rare opportunity to hear from the lives of these two women devoted to caring for those who are people living with dementia, who would just as soon not us think of them as victims, but yet, as we hear the story being told, Margie, you bring to us a sense of victimization. There's this kind of unfairness about it, I suppose. When I think of somebody who was victimized, this is somebody who was just living their life, and somehow they got targeted with this. Certainly a conversation that deserves continued exploration here. So stay with me. We're going to have more. I've got Margie Marcil, a care partner in Alzheimer's Project, and then Debbie Maroney, who is their CEO. You stay with me. We'll be right back.
When you place a document in someone's hand, it should reach more than their head. It needs to reach their heart with compelling visuals and dramatic presentations right down to the paper it's printed on. Rapid Press reaches the hearts of thousands of people every day with commercial printing and mailing services for organizations that feed and house children, for businesses that bring vital products and services to our community, and for theaters, festivals, and orchestras reaching bigger audiences and bringing joy to life. Rapid Press commercial printers since 1983.
For digital printing, offset printing, finishing, and mailing services, reach for Rapid Press. When you're ready to share your vision, excite your customers, and reach the hearts of your audience, reach for Rapid Press. You'll find them online at rapidpress.com or call 893-7346. 893-7346. Rapid Press, the power of print.
Hi, I'm Jerry.
And I'm Pete.
And we're with the Jerry Thigpen Trio, and you're listening to Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Many years ago, when I was in my latter portion of my college days, my undergraduate studies, and then on into graduate school, my mother and father living in Seattle, my sister there, notified me that my mother was beginning to show the signs of dementia. Got a phone call one evening from her, and my sister reporting this said Mom was frantically trying to figure out why her car key would not fit in the door of her car, and they finally figured out where she was and found that she was trying to open up somebody else's car. Those kinds of experiences for you, probably too many to even consider. 13 years from beginning to end. But for somebody like you, Debbie, there are another number of those same scenarios over and mm-hmm. over again. As part of that caregiving process, I'm curious, how do you deal with watching this and being very much a part of this? You too are a caregiver mm-hmm. in another way. So is there a support group for people like you who can go?
It's my staff that I get concerned about, because they're the actual ones that are really in there
doing the hands-on,
mm-hmm. and I'm kind of at the peripheral. But I can tell you that for me, when I first, the first respite program that I went to, and I'd never been to a respite program, I didn't know what it was. I just knew we did this, and we had people drop their loved one off.
Well,
they love, we have a respite day respite in five different churches in Leon County, a different church every day of the week, and then in the outer counties and three other counties, and you can drop your loved one off from 9 to 3 so that the care partner can go to the doctor, can go to take a nap, go to the grocery store, whatever that they need to do. And their loved one is in like a social club where we have music therapy and art and games. And
wow.
And they have an opportunity to be with people that are like them, living like them. And so I went to the first respite, and I fell in love with this gentleman, this Southern gentleman.
Oh.
And it was like, I couldn't stand it that, I wanted him to have the absolute best care possible and respite. So you just become attached to people because they are people and their eyes light up and their smile and they, you're not going to let me, I'm leaving, lady, and you're not going to get in my way. I mean, they also have this
sharper edge.
Sharper edge. And it's like, it was delightful. And not ever, but that's how the staff, view who we serve. And so it's just amazing.
So this respite group or groups of this, you said there are how many?
We have 5 in Tallahassee, one a different day of the week. And then we have one in Port St. Joe that meets twice a month, and we have it in Wakulla and in Gadsden County.
And these are hosted by local churches.
Well, so we're a program without borders. The churches allow us to come in. We have a CNA or a home health aide and a paid coordinator.
Okay.
And then we have volunteers because we need a ratio of about 1-3 or 1-4 per client. And so they provide these activities for the individuals living with dementia.
Okay, so this is a work of Alzheimer's Project.
Correct.
The churches are helping in providing facility.
Right.
I see.
Right.
That's remarkable.
That is remarkable.
Yeah. And you say it's without borders, so I mean any church wanting to provide you this opportunity, they could do that.
And wanted to help pay the cost of the caregiver for the staff that we have to have
indeed.
But yes. So
it's a cooperative.
It's a cooperative. It's a partnership.
Yeah.
We couldn't do what we do in Tallahassee without the over 100 volunteers in the churches that have.
Yeah.
I was able to take my husband to respite on Mondays for about 6 weeks, maybe 2 months, at which point he was getting to where they couldn't keep him inside the building. But we called it retirement club. I said, "Oh, let's go to your retirement club." And the first day we walked in, he just felt so embraced. And it was one of the things my husband really missed. He had been in the school system here for decades, and so he missed that adult socialization.
Yeah.
And when he'd walk in there, and everyone would call his name, and he'd never look back, man. I'd sign him in, and he'd go off and do his thing. And we were able to do that for a couple of months, maybe a little bit longer. And it was such a blessing.
Wow.
Such a blessing for him as well as for me.
And you got to reclaim a little bit then of your day, your time, your life.
Yes.
And do some things that needed to be done for you. Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
But it was also really, really helpful for him to be back around other adults again
isolated.
And not to, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Respite programs. Okay, so if you've been paying attention, my friend, you have to write some of these things down, probably, because like me, you're going to forget. So figure out a way that you could help these fine people. The Alzheimer's Project Incorporated is the organization. I'm certain that anything that you could contribute financially would be of great use. Right,
correct.
Debbie? Yes. Debbie's like, yes. What's the matter with you? Let's see. Where can we go? We can go to your website, I guess, to learn more. Is that right?
Yes, alzheimersproject.org.
Simple enough, alzheimersproject.org. We're going to learn more about the whole project aspect of this and the cooperative aspects of it having to do with these respite groups. So maybe you need to talk with some of the folks at your church if they're not already hosting and cooperating in this program. It's a great opportunity to be of service and a great use of a facility that otherwise, come on folks, stays vacant throughout the week. Yeah, put it to work. That's a good idea. Okay. Our friends, Debbie Maroney, she is the CEO for this marvelous program, Alzheimer's Project, Inc., and the courageous, heartfelt sharings coming from Margie Marcille, who is a care partner. Thank you both. What a joy to have you with us. I say a joy because for me, the topic itself is not necessarily joyful. There is a joy in giving you voice, giving you opportunity to bring all of us closer to you in this work that you're doing, have done, and God willing, will continue to do for some time. You certainly have my prayer and my thanks for what you're doing in bringing this to our attention and so many of the people that are being blessed because you have done this great thing. We look forward to having you back whenever it's convenient for you. Bring us more information. Let us know how we can help.
I'd love to do that.
Is that a deal?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for being with us. Folks, this is what we do here. You know that. Tallahassee Talks is the production of Alcom Media and Entertainment, coming to you from the studios of MooseMagnificatRadio.com. Go to MooseMagnificat.com. We provide you all the local musicians playing their original songs on our radio station. Carl Cerny is our executive producer. I will be looking for you again next week. So come on, Tallahassee. Come talk to me.
So if you come to me and you say, I want to buy a house, the first thing I do is meet with you and say, okay, let's talk about this process. What can you afford? And not just purchase price, your lifestyle. What kind of lifestyle do you want to have here?
Tiffany Hamilton, broker of Eck & Hamilton Realty, talking about the real estate market in Tallahassee.
Right now, for any investor, in my opinion, affordable housing is something that we should be looking at. That means a purchase price of about $185 to $250, a rental income of about $1,000 to $1,500 max.
Realtor, broker, consultant, Tiffany Hamilton is helping home buyers, investors, and other realtors achieve their individual goals.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Hamilton. Investing in real estate or buying a home has never been more challenging. Even finding solid information you can trust can also be a challenge. That's exactly why I began my career as a realtor nearly 15 years ago, to help buyers and sellers overcome those challenges. As a broker, as a realtor, or a consultant, if I can help you achieve your goals, it would be my pleasure.
Call 850-366-8433 or online at TiffanyHamilton.com.